Tremendous number of open questions, and these guys introduce us to those questions, all the research, the huge frontiers of research that remain to be explored. If you want to go down that alley, it gives you a bit of window into your possible future here. So I'm really delighted that today we have with us Ashwin Nayak. He's from the Institute for Quantum Computing, which we saw last week. Remember the tour last week? Way cool place. They're doing way cool stuff, applying quantum ideas to computing and to cryptography and other stuff to bring the magic of quantum mechanics to the real world and all that stuff. So without further ado, since we're starting late, I give you Ashwin Nayak. Warm welcome.
Thank you. So I hope you've been enjoying the school so far. As Richard said, I'm Ashwin Nayak. I'm primarily at the University of Waterloo, and I'm primarily also a computer scientist. And sometimes, or actually these days, on many occasions, I don my physicist hat. There's a small part of me which strives to be a physicist, although I'm not trained to be one. So today I'm going to be talking about a topic of current interest that is motivated from considerations that come from computer science or more broadly information processing. And so you'll see a view of quantum mechanics that perhaps you got a glimpse of when you visited IQC last week, and is, you could say, a more contemporary interpretation or presentation of quantum mechanics. So I'll start off, to motivate the whole topic with a small demo. So sorry, it doesn't matter if you're in the way. It's hopefully all of you would be able to see it. Now this here is polarizing film. And you may have seen it, probably most likely in your dentist's office when you wear those goggles, so that the light from the lamp doesn't shine into your eyes that brightly. Or you would have seen it on computer screen sometimes. People use it to dim the computer screen, the glare from the computer screen. And in many other places, in toys and such. So let's put one of these onto the overhead here. And you already see that the light was much brighter when you didn't have this film on it, right? And I put it on, and you see it's brighter on the sides, and where the film is, of course, it's a bit dimmer, right? Let's do an experiment. I'm going to turn this film around a bit, and let's see if anything changes. Do we see anything? Nothing happened. Okay, so we'll leave it at that. Let's put another one on top. Did you see a change?
No.
Let's move it halfway across. Is there a difference? Just a slight difference, right? I mean, it's slightly dimmer, and that's something you expect when you have light passing through material, right? Some of it just gets absorbed. Okay, I'm going to do another experiment. I'm going to turn this one around. Let's put it back up there, and I'm going to slowly turn it around. Okay, so what's happening? It's getting darker, right? And turn it more, and here we go. So it's great that you see the sides as well. You see that the light where the two films overlap has completely disappeared. Well, as far as we can tell, right? On the other hand, where you have just one film on these four sides, you still see light coming through at almost the same intensity. So how do you explain this phenomenon? Have you seen this before?
Yes,
okay. Good. So can one of you tell me what's going on? Yes?
One of them's worth 33 polarized and the other one's worth not polarized when you can. So the kind of eliminates the way in which light is moving as an electromagnetic wave in a certain direction, either vertically or horizontally polarized.
Okay. So so it's fantastic. It looks like, you know, I don't have to even do this demo. All of you seem to know about this. So what you just described is sort of a classical view of what's happening in here. So light, when it comes out of a source like that, so here, you know, underneath this the screen out here in the overhead projector, we have a bulb, right? And light that's emitted by it has a property which we now call polarization. And it's such that basically light is polarized. It's some notion of, you know, direction of, if you wish, the oscillations of electromagnetic waves, right? So this is sort of a classical view of light that comes from Maxwell's days and is a good first approximation to what polarization is. Now, when you put a film like this on top, so something like so, horizontally, what happens is some of the light, which is not oriented along basically a chosen direction which the filter favors, is just blocked out, right? It's absorbed by the filter. Okay? And so light that's coming out through the filter now is completely polarized in one direction. And when you put another filter on top, all that happens is some of the light gets absorbed because this is not a perfect transmitter of light. But more or less, this light, which is polarized in the favored direction, just passes through, right? And as you turn this filter around, more and more of the light gets blocked out. So let me ask you this question. Let's call this, you know, horizontally polarized, just because that's the way I've placed the filter. Why did it happen that when I placed it this way, light got completely blocked, and when I placed it this way, some of it passed through? Can someone else tell me why? Okay. Excellent. So now we come to this aspect of polarization, which sort of it's a mathematical aspect of how we describe this property of polarization, right? You know, one might think that basically, one might be tempted to think that the reason why you have light coming through as you, you know, move this film around, rotate this film around, is that basically partly, you know, light has polarization along the horizontal direction, and then partly it has polarization along, you know, all the different angles that go from 0 to 90, right, as you turn the film around. And, you know, more of it has horizontal polarization having come through the film, and then, you know, not much, or in fact little to none, has anything along the vertical direction, right? How do you describe such a thing, right? The appropriate description, turns out, is not as a scalar quantity, which is, you know, which would tell us what proportion of light comes through at different angles, but in fact as a vector, right? I'm sorry? That's right. So the correct way to view this thing, and I'll show it to you in a moment, is that right now, let me just make it this way. You can think of some property, which we're calling the polarization of light. Let's think of it as the direction of oscillation of the electric field, for example. Let's say it's horizontal, right? When I place the film oriented along this direction, what's happening is that the component of this vector that lies along this direction is what's being let through, what's getting transmitted through, right? And you see that this vector is of length that's smaller than the original one. So if you think of this as 100% of light passing through, then only a fraction of it is getting through here, right? Now you can try to, you know, push this idea further and try to sort of reconcile it with this modern view of light, which is this particulate view of light in terms of, you know, as being composed of photons, right? And ask yourself, is it that, okay, so I've already, you know, jumped further ahead, so clearly what I'm going to say is not going to work, which is it that individual photons have, you know, polarization along different directions, and because you have so many of them coming along, that some of them are oriented one way, some of them the other way, and so on? Or is there more to it, right? So for example, another explanation could have been that maybe some fraction of photons are polarized this way, some fraction of them have their electric field, you know, oscillating in that direction, and so on, right? So this is something I've just said before. And now, you know, those photons that are aligned this way pass through through the first film, and when I put the second one, basically somehow, well, clearly it couldn't be that those photons which were originally oriented this way are now coming through, right? Because the first filter would have done something to them. So think about, well, the best way to think about this whole property is to first sort of take you to first take yourself to this regime where you dim this source of light so that, you know, you don't have billions and billions of photons coming through, but just one. So you dim it down further, and wait until you have one photon coming through, right? And ask yourself, how does this property of polarization behave when you're observing this one photon, right? And the only explanation that makes sense here is that, well, one, when you place the film horizontally like so, if the photon has its polarization aligned like this, it passes through. And, well, if it's not, you know, let's say this is the polarization of the photon originally and your film is at that angle, then what's passing through is, well, does the photon, a fraction of the photon pass through, or is it something else that's happening?
Probability.
Sorry?
It's a probability,
right? So what really is happening here is you think of the photon either entirely passing through or entirely being absorbed, right? And these two events, these two very distinct events, happen probabilistically, right? And the probability with which it happens is basically given by the length squared of this vector here, okay? So that's, you know, that's in short how polarization behaves, how quantum superposition behaves, right? You think of the photon as being simultaneously in a combination of two polarizations, one which is aligned along the film and one which is perpendicular to the film, right? And this polarization, which is this vector, basically is independent of this you know, artificial frame of reference that I put on, and as I rotate it, you can still express the polarization of the photon. If you move this around, I can still express my vector as some combination of vertical and horizontal. And at every rotation, at every sort of angle that you put it, some component of it gets through with 100% some component of it with probability, you know, proportional to its length squared gets through and some not. Okay, so let's move on. I wanted to do something else. Okay, so the next thing I wanted to do was place this at this 45, well, roughly 45 degree angle, right? And let's erase this for a moment. Maybe before I do it at 45 degrees, remember what happened when I put it this way, right? So when I placed this, these two perpendicular to each other, there was no light getting through. I place it at 45 degrees. And now I'm going to put another one on top at 90 degrees to the original one. What's going to happen? Some light's still going to get through, right? And maybe I'll move it around and you'll see the difference, right? So here, you see almost no light's getting through, right? This is where the bottom and the top are at 90 degrees. And here, you have three films through which the light passes, right? The bottom one horizontal, then 45 degrees, and the third one at 45 degrees to the second one. So the only way you can explain it is that, well, first, you have, you know, the first film choosing photons that are horizontally polarized. And then when you place the second one along this axis, then this component is what comes through. And finally, when you place it vertically like so, this is the component that comes through. Right? So whereas originally there was none coming through, now you have the photon coming through with a certain probability. And can you tell me what this probability would be? Let's say this was really 45 degrees. It's 1/4, right? Because the projection of this unit length vector onto this axis has length 1 over square root 2. And then if you, the length squared is then 1/2. So with probability 1/2, you observe this photon coming through this filter. And then a further probability of 1/2 because you placed the last filter at 45 degrees. Okay, so I'm going to be using this phenomenon to show you something neat that you can do with, in the computer science world. So let me switch to my presentation here. Let's see. We'll turn this off and ask. Sorry? Okay. Let me try to, how do I get the little window off? Okay, good. All right, so very quick run through. The polarization of light you can view as a vector, where this vector may be resolved along, you know, the axis of polarization of the film, horizontal plus vertical. And then we saw the horizontal component of light passes through, vertical component does not. And that this is not a bulk phenomenon in the sense that every photon of light basically has its own polarization. And this you can represent as this vector. And then either the photon, the entire photon is blocked, or the entire photon is transmitted, right? So this property of light is actually used in many places, and this is one place where I didn't mention in the beginning. Can you tell me what the difference between these two is?
Glare.
Oh, there are many, sorry?
Glare or no glare? Off the windows, you see the reflection.
Oh, perfect. That is very quick. Does everyone see that? If you, I mean, there are many differences between these two photographs. I mean, you know, you see more letters here than here, but that's not the point. I mean, I'm trying to look at some, look at what it is to do with light, what property of light you can spot in this. And you see here in the lower windows that less of the light that is reflected from the windows comes through in the photograph on the right, right? So here you can see a blurry reflection of some trees, perhaps. And on top, you can see a reflection of the sky and other objects. And here, you in fact see what's inside the windows, right? So light that is coming, that's being reflected by the windows, is, in this case, polarized. In fact, I was doing this sitting in my office because there's this big glass building right across. And as I was turning the film, I could block off some of the reflection and see exactly this. In fact, I tried it with the windows across the building, but looks like those, you know, those windows don't quite polarize light the same way. Anyway, I have some polarizing film here, which you can, you know, at some point, where is it? That's my, when you get a chance to step out, you can try to see which windows do that for you. There, you can pass this around if you like. So as I said, the photograph on the right was taken with the polarizing filter. And you often do this to, you know, especially when you take photographs of, let's say, fish inside water, when often often basically what you see is the surface of the water reflecting the sky or the trees or whatever else is around you, right? And you want to block that out and you want to get to the fish. You use a polarizing filter. There it is. Okay. So let's see how you can use this phenomenon to do something really cool. Let's say one of you wants to send a note across. So I don't know any of you here, but so I created these two fictional characters, Alice and Bob. Alice is sitting at one corner, let's say you're Alice, and Bob is sitting in another corner. And let's say you want to send a note right while I'm giving this lecture, as you normally want to do, to Bob, right? So what's a tried and tested method of doing that? You scribble something on a little sheet of paper, you fold it up, and you pass it on to your neighbor, right? And then you ask them in a, you know, barely disguised whisper to pass it on to Bob. And you do this until it gets to Bob. Well, hopefully, right? And you hope that no one else in the middle reads your note. Right, because clearly it's something only Bob needs to see. How do you keep anyone else from guessing or reading or, you know, getting at what you've written on the note?
Put a seal on it.
Put a seal on it, yes, you can put a seal on it, but nothing prevents anyone in the middle from opening it and then passing it on to you. You'll know that someone's read it, but, you know, your secret's still gone. It's compromised. Write it in a different language. Yes, that's a good start. And hope that no one else in the, you know, in the room understands your language, or the one that you used. So you see, that's right. I mean, I guess I've already put it on top. This is one way of hiding information from those that you do not wish to get to your, you know, get to your information, right? So get to your note. One of the first methods of encryption, of hiding data, hiding messages, that has been recorded is that of, is known as the Caesar cipher, because you know Julius Caesar used to use this this method, a very simple-minded method to send messages to his generals. What he would do is he would shift the Roman alphabet by a few places. In fact, he used to shift it by three. So A is written down as a D, B as E, and so on, all the way up to the end, and then you would circle around to ABC, right? It's a simple-minded way of encryption, but it's quite effective. So let's see how this one would read. So you would take T and then, well, substitute it with W, H, and let's see where this goes, to K, E, to H, and so on, right? So what you'd get is something like this. And you see, it's pretty effective, at least if you don't have the time to, you know, unscramble the message, right? Of course, if you knew already that this was the cipher that was being used, it's very easy to crack, right? But then you might, Alice might try to be more clever. She might use some other substitution. She might use an unknown shift that's only known to Bob, right? So she says, okay, I'm not going to shift it by 3. I'm going to shift it by 10, right? And no one else knows what the shift was. So that makes it a bit more complicated, but it's not that much more complicated, right? Because anyone who tries all possible shifts can still get to the message, right? So there are only 26 such shifts. You just try them one after the other, and if you're quick enough, as computers now tend to be, you'll very quickly get to the message. And you don't even need to hold on to the note while you're doing this. You can quickly record the note, whatever it said, right? Pass it on, and then your computer can chug away and check what the message is on the side, right? So Bob doesn't even need to know what's happened to the message, whether it's been intercepted or not. He has no idea whether this has happened. When you put the seal, there was a way for him to check whether the seal was broken or not, right? But someone else who's equally clever and has the sort of method or has the resources to reconstruct the seal can fool even him, right, if you use the seal. Okay, so you try to be even more clever. You say you're not going to use shifts, you're going to use substitutions. Is there a problem with that? Yes? Okay, how many different permutations of 26 letters are there? I'm sorry? 26 factorial. How big a number is that? A computer can maybe handle it, but not really as quickly as you'd like, right? So 26 factorial, I had my calculator calculate. Do you have the answer? That's right. So although 26 factorial is too big a number, it's like a billion, 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 right? So 10 to the power 26, almost. Okay, it's actually more than 4 times 10 to the power 26. So a computer may be able to do it, But it'll take, actually, it won't even be able to do it in your lifetime, most likely, right? Even computers as fast as we have today. But there's something else that comes to your rescue, which is what your fellow student pointed out, that in a typical piece of text in English, the frequency of the letters looks something like that, okay? So, you know, the letter E is the most common, and the next one that I don't think you can see this that clearly, at least not from this distance there, that's T, and so on. So the vowels O, and you see where is that I here, are next most, and A, of course, right, are the next most frequent, and so on. So you can try to match the letters. So if you have a long piece of text that has been encoded using some arbitrary permutation of the letters, you can try to look at the frequencies of the letters in that piece of text. Provided it's long enough, it's going to be quite close to this histogram. Okay? And that's going to give you a better guess for what the substitution cipher is. So the point I'm trying to make is, no matter how clever you try to be with your encryption scheme, right? It looks like a clever enough person, so someone equally clever or perhaps more clever than you are, can break it. Okay. So I'm going to show you another little puzzle. And this is to try to motivate a scheme that, that we'll see next. So here's a first piece of text. It's just a sequence of ones and minuses, and I picked the minus because it's more visible than zero, right? But the reason I'm picking a piece of text with two digits, two symbols, is because that's how we represent data in a computer, right? It's represented by zeros and ones. So think of the minuses here as zeros. So this is supposed to be some piece of text, and let's go to the next one. That's the second piece. I'm sorry?
You shifted it.
I shifted it. Okay, let's go back. How do you go back? Okay. There. It took a few clicks. I'm sorry? Did I flip it? So let's pick something at the left corner here. It's a zero. Let's look at the next, these two. Let's look at these. Did I flip them? So far, yes. Oops. Well, I gave away my secret. Okay. That's actually the difference. Now, this... okay. So the difference here, I really did not mean what the difference is between the individual, whether one was a, one letter on the top left corner was a minus or a one. But the difference I'm talking about is a difference modulo 2. So imagine that you're doing arithmetic modulo 2. Which means, if you add 0 to 0, you get 0. Let me write this arithmetic modulo 2 as this plus with a circle around it. And if you add 0 to 1, you still get 1. 1 to 0, you still get 1. But when you add 1 to 1, you wrap it around, right? You get a 0. Now, this operation happens to be a very well-behaved operation. It gives you an operation that is very similar to the regular addition that you're very familiar with, and is very convenient to use when you're processing data on a computer. Now, the difference, as it happens, so if you you know, if you think about the operation which is the inverse of this one here, addition modulo 2, turns out that the operation itself is its inverse, right? So if you want to subtract 1 from something, it's equivalent to adding 1 to that number, okay? And you can verify this very quickly just using this table. So the difference to which I refer to out here is precisely the difference between this piece of text and that piece of text taken as a big long string and done bitwise. So you look at, you know, let's pick this one here, right? It's a minus plus a 1 should give you a 1, right? And I did that with every single bit in this piece of text, and I got this logo. So what's the point of this, these three pictures? Has anybody guessed? Yes? That's right. So this piece of text looks completely random, right? There's nothing intelligible you can get from this. So is this, right? But this happens to be an encryption of this PI logo. And the way I got to text B was to take my message and add text A to it, right? And I've completely scrambled it to get that. This is an instance of what's known as now known as the Wernham cipher, after one of the inventors of the cipher. And the goal of this cipher is to make your ciphertext, meaning the result of your encryption, look completely random. Right, so something like the two pieces of text A and B. And how do you do this? Well, so Alice and Bob, our favorite characters in this story, they meet up, you know, beforehand, before class, and they toss a coin. Now the outcome of the coin is either heads or tails, and I represent that as a 0 or 1. And then they come to class, and while I'm lecturing, Alice feels the itch to send a message to Bob. So she has some message. Let's imagine that she's being very terse. She has just one bit to send across. It's a 0 or 1. What she does is she takes this bit and adds her coin toss, K, to it, modulo 2. So the result is another bit. Let's call it the ciphertext C. And she sends this across, okay? What's the point of this? The point is that this key, K, is, you know, to anyone else in the room, equally likely to be 0 or 1, right? And anyone that does not know the value of the key, so Alice and, you know, everyone except Alice and Bob, have no knowledge of it. Moreover, if you look at what happens to the message, so the column here is the message, right? It's either 0 or 1. And the key, which is unknown to everyone but 2, is 0 or 1 with equal probability and has been added to your message. So look at what happens out here. Look at the first row. If the message was 0, you get 0 with probability 1/2 and 1 with probability 1/2, right? And if the message was 1, it's still the same distribution over the two possible values. So no matter what the message was, the ciphertext is equally likely to be 0 or 1 to anyone but Alice and Bob, right? So you manage to somehow make every message look identical and identically random, right? And you can do this for longer messages. Point is, you do this bitwise, meaning you pick a number of coin tosses, which you know is a bound on the length of the message that you need to send. So if you're going to write like a 100-word note, then you're going to pick as many bits as will allow you to do this letter by letter. And you use it in the same manner. So here's a sender and a receiver. Both have agreed upon a uniformly random sequence of coin tosses, which I'm calling capital K. And there is some plain text, the message that you need to send, which is composed of bits. The way you encrypt it is by adding the key to it, modulo 2, bitwise. And then to everyone in the middle, that is perhaps in the way, on the way from the sender to the receiver, this ciphertext looks completely random, no matter what X is and no matter what K is. Only the receiver is able to decode what the message was. So this method of encryption is completely secure in a very strong sense that unless any eavesdropper has any information about this key, he or she gets nothing by looking at the ciphertext, even if he or she keeps a copy of this ciphertext around for as long as you wish. In fact, this was proven formally by Shannon, Claude Shannon, the father of information theory, as we know it today, in the late 50s. Now, this method is this fantastic method which has this very strong notion of security, but comes with a few disadvantages, a few weaknesses. Can you imagine what they could be? I'm sorry? Okay, but perhaps you could meet up before, like you did. Right? And I'm sorry?
That's kind of inconvenient for our modern technology. We want to be able to just do everything remotely.
That's right. So think about phone banking, right? I don't know how many of you have bank accounts, probably many of you. You might even have operated your bank account over the phone, perhaps even over the computer, right? Every time you want to access your bank account, right, you don't need to go to the bank and set up the secret key so that your information, the information such as your account number, let's say the PIN with which you access your bank account over the phone or the computer, is kept secret, right? There is some mechanism in place so that the information that is going between you and the bank is kept secure, right? And that is not possible if you use this kind of encryption, right? Unless you have met beforehand and agreed upon this key. In fact, it becomes even more more serious when you have, I don't know how many of you are here, maybe 50. So if you have 50 people in this classroom who all want to send secret notes to each other, right? If you have 50 people, then the number of secret keys you'd need to set up is basically 50 squared by 2, right? Every pair of you would have to meet up and decide on some number of coin tosses. So that's the first major disadvantage. The second one is that once you have used this key for one message, it's, strictly speaking, no longer as secure the second time you use it, right? Eventually, if you have a collection of ciphertexts, you are going to be able to figure out what the key was and what the message is. So it's only secure when you use it once, right? And as I said, you have to meet physically to share these keys because, of course, you couldn't pick up the phone and toss a coin. and send the value of the outcome across, because anyone who was who was tapping your phone line could easily get to it. So this is where photon polarization comes in. So in the rest of the talk, what I'll describe is a method of establishing the secret key between two users without actually physically having to meet and do the exchange. So we'll see how it enables this process called remote key agreement. And therefore, once you've agreed upon the key, you'd be in a position to send secret messages. And as I was, as I mentioned, it gives you an alternative to the way things are done today. The way you are able to use the computer and your phone to do banking is because of public key encryption, which I won't describe. But this is a kind of scheme where basically the messages that you send are encrypted with a method, and the security of this method called most often RSA with a combination of other things, the security of this method is based on an unproven assumption, right? It's based on experience that a particular computational problem, which is that of factorizing integers into prime numbers, is essentially intractable, in the sense that the best way we know to crack the code is to, there are, roughly speaking, just trying out all the different possibilities, just like you had in mind for the permutation cipher, right? And the number of possibilities are so large that in the time that you wish to crack the code, you will definitely not be able to do it. Nonetheless, turns out that by using quantum mechanics to build computers that are much more powerful than the ones we have today, it's been shown that this method is completely broken, meaning there is a way to factorize integers that also breaks this public key crypto system. Okay? So we'd like to come up with a method that goes back to this this information theoretically secure method of sending messages, which is private key encryption. And this is exactly what we'll see next. Okay. So we'll see how, using polarized light, we'll be able to establish a secure random key. And I'll argue, I won't show it to you in too much detail, how and why an eavesdropper probably has little information about the key. And the best thing about this protocol will be that as long as quantum mechanics is the correct way or the right description or an accurate description of how nature behaves, this protocol is completely secure. Okay, so maybe I'll pause for a moment, take questions, ask Richard how much time I have, and continue after that. Okay. Okay, so I'll modify accordingly.
So private key encryption is completely different than public key encryption. It's actually different methods of sending messages.
That's right. Any other questions so far? Okay, so let's move on. So the protocol I'm going to describe was given by Bennett and Brassard, now almost 25 years ago, more than 25 years ago. Actually, Like everything quantum mechanical, it was met with a lot of resistance. You know, just like you might feel when somebody's imposing, I don't know, a new language on you, or even quantum mechanics, right? It appears to be such a bizarre description of how nature could be, and how different it is from our day-to-day experience. This method which they proposed was met with equal incredulity, right? And it took them a few years to publish it. It finally appeared in 84. And I'll follow their description of the protocol right here. So assume, again, for simplicity, that we have two parties, Alice and Bob, sitting across the room. And they have, Alice has one bit that she wants to send to Bob. And they want to create one bit of key so that this one bit remains secret. So Alice herself tosses a coin. She picks 0 or 1 uniformly at random. And then she picks a random orientation of this polarizing film. I wonder where it went. OK, I've kept it in the corner. I have one more here, so I can use that. Let's use these two. It's more convenient. Oops. So she has this photon gun, and she's going to use this polarization filter to create the photon in a particular polarization, right? So she'll create this photon, a single photon. You know, she has this fantastic gun that produces a single photon at will. So she creates it with a polarization that's either aligned along the rectilinear axis, so either horizontal or vertical, or along one of the two diagonal axes, right? So at 45 degrees to the horizontal or vertical. Okay? So very quickly, if she has a bit 0 in mind, so she tossed this coin, she got 0 or 1, and the orientation she picked was rectilinear, then she would encode 0 as this vertical, let's say, polarized photon. Or if her outcome was 1 for the coin toss, she would encode it as the horizontally polarized photon. And similarly, for the diagonal, she would either have it, you know, the 0 going as diagonal up or diagonal down. Okay, what happens next? She sends this photon to Bob. Now Bob knows neither the bit that she picked, so he doesn't know the outcome of the coin toss, nor does he know which orientation, so rectilinear or diagonal, Alice picked. So he does the best he can. He wants to get to know the bit. He picks a random orientation, either horizontal or diagonal, orients his filter like so or like that, depending on his choice, and he measures the polarization. Now, with 50% chance, he would have got the orientation correctly, right? So let's say the orientation was horizontal to begin with. With 50% probability, he would have chosen the rectilinear basis to measure in, and he would have got it right, right? And he gets the correct bit. If he is wrong, though, so if he picks instead the diagonal polarization, then his bit will be completely random, right? So if this was the polarization originally, this is the basis in which he measures, then he has 50% chance of getting diagonal up, 50% diagonal down. Both outcomes are wrong. Actually, not quite, because this encodes a 1, and with 50% chance, he'll get the correct outcome, but he doesn't really know it, right? Okay, so Bob doesn't know whether his outcome is correct. What does he do with his outcome? He tells Alice that he's measured his photon. And after that, Alice tells him the orientation, right? Whether she used horizontal or diagonal. Now, what's the use of this? Well, she's still not told him which bit was sent, right? What the outcome of the coin toss was. So anyone who's listening still does not know what the outcome of the coin toss was. But they know, of course, the orientation. So at this point, Bob knows whether he picked the correct orientation, horizontal or diagonal. And if he picked horizontal, he knows that the outcome he got was correct, and he can keep that single bit as the key. That is still going to be the random coin toss, right? So provided he picked the right basis in which to measure the photon, he has achieved, they have achieved, a single bit of key which is uniformly random. Okay, and all of this, of course, if no one in the middle intercepted the photon, right? So now we've got to worry about what happens if someone in the middle wants to know what the key bit was, so that later on they'll, you know, take this and try to crack the message that Alice sent. Okay, so here's Eve. She's trying to measure the photon to try to get at the key. Now she doesn't know, you know, either the key bit, the outcome of the coin toss, neither does she know the basis that was picked, horizontal or rectilinear or diagonal, right? So as far as she knows, the photon that she has intercepted could be in any one of these polarizations, any one of these four, right? If she tries to measure it in any one orientation, so let's say she picks the diagonal basis, right? She'll only be able to get the key bit provided Alice also use the diagonal basis to encode, right? And in the other case, when the rectilinear basis was used, she would completely randomize the key, right? The outcome would be 0 with probability 1/2 and 1 with probability 1/2, right? So the point I'm trying to get at is the moment that Eve tries to measure this photon with some chance, with non-negligible chance, she is going to disturb the polarization from what it was originally. As in my example, if she picked the diagonal basis to measure with probability 1/2, she would disturb it to, you know, these two polarizations, whereas originally there was 0 or 1 in the diagonal basis. So Alice and Bob then have a chance to check whether there was some eavesdropping or not, right? How do they check? They actually repeat their original procedure, that of sending, you know, photons in one of these four polarizations, and then, you know, Bob measuring in a random basis, Bob announcing that he's measured the photons, and finally Alice telling him telling him what bases she used for each of the photons. And then they do some tests, right? What they do is they pick a random subset of the photons they sent. And for these photons, Alice will actually tell Bob what the polarization she encoded was, right? So for example, if she had picked the diagonal basis, she's actually also going to say which polarization it was, 0 or 1, right? And if by chance Eve had used this vertically, you know, vertical orientation, the rectilinear orientation to measure in, which would happen, you know, which she would do with good chance because she didn't know the orientation to begin with, then Bob would notice with 50% chance that the outcome was 0 or 1, you know, different from the original polarization. So if it was 0, let's say, with probability 1/2, he would observe a 1. So he would see a difference with the key bit that Alice had originally sent. So if there are too many such errors, then they know that somebody is maliciously intervening in their messages. And they just completely discard everything they've done so far. They abort the protocol, and they restart the whole process. OK? Yeah? So let's say you begin with 400 photons. To get, you know, ideal security, you would pick half of them, let's say, you know, 200 to test for eavesdropping. Okay, so this would mean, I mean, what this achieves is basically a probability of detection which is exponentially close to 1, meaning, you know, as far close to 1 of detecting eavesdropping as you would like in practice. That's right. So let's say you send 400 bits or 400 photons, right? The first thing to note is that Bob only gets half of the orientations correctly on average. So you would have 200 photons on which the photons were prepared and measured in the same basis, right? So you would come down to 200 photons, which were useful, and then you would test half of them, so 100 of them, right? So you would be left with 100, right? So it's roughly a quarter. Actually, there's more that happens after that, which will reduce it to a smaller fraction, so maybe 50, right? Okay. So the informal arguments that I've been giving you so far actually can be made mathematically rigorous, and this was done almost 15 years after the protocol was originally proposed by a set of authors, Myers and then Loewen Chow. And is one of the triumphs of quantum information. And the outcome at the bottom line of this is that provided you're able to satisfy a few basic requirements of this protocol, for example, produce single photons at will. Well, these are not very simple things to do, and I'm saying it very casually, but in principle, these things are doable, right? So produce photons, single photons, polarized accurately along one of those four directions. Seal your labs so that no one else can get to them. Have 100% transmission in your optical fiber, and so on. So provided you can meet these engineering requirements, this protocol is secure as long as we know that the world moves, runs, you know, behaves according to quantum mechanics. Okay, and it has nothing to do with how intelligent we are, how clever we are in trying to break the system. And in fact, you might have seen prototypes that have now been built and are being used in many different places over the world. In fact, there's one, you know, link between Perimeter and IQC that's actually through AIR. That, I don't know whether you had a chance to look at that. Probably did. Okay. So I was actually going to show you one other thing, but I'll stop here. In fact, much has happened since this quantum key distribution protocol was discovered. And let's see, can I fast forward to the end? How do I, using this? Okay. Okay, there. Okay. Okay, so all of that, you know, that transpired in the last 10 seconds was the description of a protocol that was meant to toss a coin over the phone. So, you know, Alice and Bob, let's say, are talking to each other, and they know that quantum key distribution is possible, so they try to adapt, you know, take ideas from that protocol and use it to agree on a coin toss. Actually, they've fought, and, you know, so they can't stand the sight of each other, and they can only talk on the phone, and basically, Bob wants the teddy back that he, you know, gave to Alice when they first met. And, you know, Alice is, she's too fond of the teddy and doesn't want to give it back, and they decide the only way, well, to resolve this is by tossing a coin. So they try to do this over the phone. The protocol, which you saw, I don't know, in passing, was something they came up with and looked possibly secure, the same way that the quantum key distribution protocol is. But turns out, using very simple ideas from quantum mechanics, in fact, the idea of entanglement, you can break that particular protocol. So anyway, I can leave the slides with Richard if, you know, if he wants to post them somewhere, and if you, you know, want to take a look, you can take a look at this at leisure. What I wanted to point out was that, you know, it's with this, that example, was that it's very, you know, tempting to imagine that quantum mechanics makes everything possible, right? And in fact, using all these bizarre properties of polarization, for example, that you might be able to do things like coin tossing. But still, there are, turns out, you know, that there are many tasks that we cannot accomplish, even with the power of quantum mechanics. So the landscape of information processing becomes even more subtle than it was, you know, before quantum information came into the picture. Okay. There was a silver lining to that discussion, which was on the previous slide, which was that although you cannot accomplish coin flipping with, you know, the requirements you had originally in mind, there are relaxed versions of it that we can indeed get to if we had sufficient resources. And there are many other protocols that we would like to have. For example, as we speak, people are trying to concoct methods of, or rather schemes, by which you can have quantum money, right? Money that, well, I don't have any on me, but money that you can't simply go take to a, you know, to a color photocopier and reproduce, right? That's something that you can do with, you can easily fool a little child with a color photocopy of a note, right? So there are things that we would like to be able to do to basically overcome the weaknesses of our many day-to-day, you know, technologies that we have currently in place. And quantum mechanics might provide a route to these, you know, overcoming the weaknesses of these technologies. There are many problems like quantum money, like sort of effective coin tossing schemes, effective things like, well, what are known as zero knowledge proof systems that we would like to achieve and are wide open for you if you would like to explore this area further. So let me stop with that. Thanks for your patience, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay here.
Are you going to be around for lunch?
I hadn't planned.
So the kids have lunch right now until 1. Mm-hmm. If you're not available, I should have asked you before. But if you're not available, excellent. If you want, excellent.
So I can hang out for a moment.